From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I am Farai Chidea. The votes are in. Hillary Clinton wins narrowly in Indiana. Barack Obama sweeps North Carolina by a double-digit margin, and the ripple effects are already making headlines. This morning, former presidential candidate and former Senator George McGovern switched sides and urged Senator Clinton to drop out of the race. To break down the state of the race, we have NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. Hey, Ron.
Good day to you, Farai.
So, some people say a win is a win, no matter what. Hillary Clinton took Indiana by a 3-point margin. Let's listen to her from last night's speech in Indianapolis.
Not too long ago, my opponent made a prediction. He said I would probably win Pennsylvania. He would win North Carolina. And Indiana would be the tiebreaker. Tonight, we've come from behind. We've broken the tie, and thanks to you, it's full speed onto the White House.
So, Ron, you know, how important was this victory?
I think if she had not eked out a very small victory, about 22,000 votes in Indiana, she probably would have had absolutely no rationale for continuing her campaign today. It is very difficult to imagine how she could go to the superdelegates after as disappointing a night as she had last night if it had been, in a sense, symbolized as even more disappointing by not getting the W in Indiana. But that is the way politics works. It's a little bit like sports. You know, 1 point in a basketball game in which 200 points are scored determines who is the winner and who is the loser. And in this particular case of Indiana, she managed to hold on. Now, does that take away all the headlines this morning that were focused on North Carolina, a much larger state, a top 10 population state, where Barack Obama won by 14 points, by 230,000 votes? No, that will still be the dominant impression from this particular day in the primaries. And the Clinton forces had been hoping for a very different scenario out of this day.
Now, she says she's full speed ahead, but she just lent $6.4 million to her campaign over the past month. There's six more contests coming up. Will she even be able to get the funds to go the distance?
I think she will be able to get the funds to go the distance for this reason, that the six remaining events are not going to be terribly expensive. West Virginia and Kentucky and Puerto Rico are not particularly expensive places for her to win because she's already well ahead in all three, and she'll be able to bring those into her column. At the same time, South Dakota, Montana, and Oregon, only Oregon is expensive in those three, but it looks difficult for her to overcome the advantages Barack Obama has in those states. In other words, there's not a great deal of suspense about the remaining six events, and they have between them only a little over 200 delegates available. So there are now more superdelegates out, about 270, than there are regular pledged delegates to be won in these events. Last night was really the last major primary night.
Now, when we talk about that magic number where one person outright wins the nomination, is it mathematically possible at this point that either of them could hit the magic number?
Not without superdelegates, of course. And the new strategy from the Clinton forces, of course, is to argue that the magic number is not the magic number, that 2025 is not what one will need to be nominated, but rather a much higher number, which assumes Florida and Michigan will be seated. Well, Florida and Michigan probably will in the end be seated, but not along the formula of delegate allocation lines that the Clinton people would like. What will happen is there will be a split that will not make that much difference to Hillary Clinton, and therefore the number 2025 is still pretty much the number.
Now, as I mentioned just this morning, former presidential candidate and former Clinton supporter George McGovern switched his endorsement to Barack Obama, called for Hillary Clinton to withdraw from the race. What's the significance of his statement?
It's probably not going to change very many people's minds, but it may signal the beginning of a movement on the part of, if you will, the elder statespersons of the Democratic Party toward this new position of saying, you know, whether I liked Hillary Clinton or I liked Barack Obama, it's now time to set that aside and get a nominee. And we do have a candidate who's closing in on the nomination, and the only means by which the other candidate could deny him that nomination are just not things we want to think about.
All right, Ron. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Farai.
That was NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving, and he joined me at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Now we've got analysis from Democratic strategist Donna Brazile. She is an author and nationally syndicated columnist, and Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying group D.C. Navigators. He's also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Great to have you on, as always, folks.
Nice to be with you.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So, Donna, let me start with you. Senator Clinton was just blasted in North Carolina and barely got the win in Indiana. Does her argument to stay in the race still work?
Well, first of all, I think that Senator Clinton should stay in the race as long as she believes that she has a shot at winning the nomination. The math is pretty difficult at this point. Senator Obama not only leads in the delegate vote, but he's also leading in the popular vote. And even if she included both Florida and Michigan, Senator Obama would still lead in the popular vote. But the only metric that matter is the earned delegates. And there are 217 outstanding earned delegates in the remaining six primaries. And given the math, it appears that it's impossible. But given the state of the party, and when I'm talking about the psychology, and perhaps it's worth noting that if she stays in the race to help unite the party in the closing days of the campaign, it could be helpful and beneficial to the eventual nominee to have her in the race to the bitter end.
How so?
Well, I think her supporters are passionate. And there's a case that Senator Clinton can make, along with Senator Obama, that the Democratic Party offers better ideas, better solutions to our problems. And if she can campaign in the closing weeks because she's on the ballot and she would like to do a final stretch, fine. I see no reason to tell Senator Clinton to get out the race if her purpose in staying in the race is to help unite the party. If the purpose is to help damage or to damage the eventual nominee, Senator Obama, then you will hear calls from superdelegates and others for Senator Clinton to abandon her campaign. But I want to think positive, and as an undeclared superdelegate, my purpose is to try to, you know, get the party to come together at this hour.
Ron, let's listen to a little bit of Hillary Clinton last night in Indianapolis.
I know these stories, and I see you, and I hear you. And I know how hard you're working for yourselves and working for your families. And I will never stop fighting for you.
Now, Donna just said that it's actually good for the party to have her and her supporters still in the game, still hopeful. You may be on the other side of the aisle, but what do you think about that?
Look, I think every day that Senator Clinton stays in the race and doesn't coalesce and unify behind Senator Obama, it becomes that more of a challenge, and it will take a little bit more time for the party to unify. Look, Senator Clinton last night, she had a fellow behind her in Indianapolis who had a pair of boxing gloves up there on the stage, and she needed an upset knockout win in North Carolina. She needed something to continue the momentum that she had had in the press for the last couple weeks, to knock Senator Obama further off of his step in his game, as well as winning in Indiana. Well, what happened last night is that she got blown out by such a great extent there in North Carolina that Senator Obama was able to, in the popular vote at least, take away the advantage that she had had in Pennsylvania. So the arguments that she has to continue with only 217 pledged delegates left dwindle with each day. She can't make it up with the six contests, one of those in Puerto Rico, and she's not going to likely surpass him in the popular vote. So if I were advising Senator Clinton, and again, she said last night, and so did Senator Obama, that it's not about them, but it's about the future. If it's truly not about them, they need to do what's in the best interest of the party. But as a Republican, I'm enjoying watching the spectacle.
Now, Senator Obama seemed to be back on his game last night. Let's hear a clip from his North Carolina victory speech.
Yes, there have been bruised feelings on both sides. Yes, each side desperately wants their candidate to win. But ultimately, this race is not about Hillary Clinton. It's not about Barack Obama. It's not about John McCain. This election is about you, the American people.
So that's clearly a populist message, Donna. The bitter comment issue was big, and then it went away, and Reverend Wright came up, and it's maybe fading away. Do you think he's going to be able to use populist themes to get frankly, you know, white working class swing voters.
There's no question that Senator Obama must neutralize Senator Clinton's advantage on the economy. What we saw last night, especially in, say, in Indiana, Senator Obama was able to make up ground white voters. North of Indianapolis, the largest city, Senator Obama won many of those counties. He improved with Catholics. He improved with white males. He's still having some difficulty with older voters, but by and large, I think Senator Obama's core message that he will change the way Washington works is a message that can resonate if he's able to have time to go into those communities and to really do what Senator Obama finally started doing, that is walk among the people. I think to the extent that they see him on the ground and not on stage, he really did well. He covered a lot of ground in 1 week.
Just quickly, give me a snippet of what you think about the swing voters, Ron.
The swing voters, I think it depends obviously on who the nominee is. I think if Senator Obama is the eventual nominee, it will be very interesting to see Senator McCain and Senator Obama vie for that very important constituency. But at this stage of the game, again, all the focus is on the Democratic side of the ledger, and they need a nominee, and they need one sooner rather than later.
Well, Ron and Donna, I want you to stay with us. We're going to go to a quick break. And just ahead, we look at what other political races are bringing the heat across the country. And our bloggers remember Mildred Loving. In 1967, she and her husband spurred the Supreme Court to finally overturn laws forbidding interracial marriage. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We are continuing our discussion on Tuesday's primary races with Democratic strategist Donna Brazil and Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying group DC Navigators. Now, Donna, I am going to go straight to you. You have been quiet on who you plan on backing as a superdelegate, but you also said on TV that you're not undecided, you are just undeclared. So when are you going to tip your hand?
As soon as I believe it's important that we unify the party, look, I want to be able to talk to my friends on the Clinton side as well as my friends on the Obama side and say, okay, how do we get along? How do we pull this party back together? I'm not interested in using my vote as a superdelegate to hurt, demonize, or denigrate one candidate over another. I tell people as a African-American woman, I'm comfortable with both candidates, and I would like to, at the end of the day, help to unify the party.
Ron, when you look at the Republican race, Senator McCain just hasn't gotten as much press because he's not contesting anyone at this point. What do you think he's going to do specifically on these populist issues like the economy that seem to be driving voters' attention?
Well, Senator McCain has been using his time while the Democrats have sucked all the oxygen out of the room to travel to different constituencies in different areas of the country that not only perhaps have not seen a Republican candidate for office visit, but particularly not one running for president of the United States. And I'm thinking specifically, of course, on the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King, for Senator McCain to show up and give a speech on civil rights in Memphis, and for his swing through rural areas, Hispanic areas, and try to diversify the Republican base. That's one of the ways that Senator McCain has the best shot of taking on the eventual Democratic nominee, Farai, which is to appeal to those independent voters, appeal to those who perhaps have not had been asked for the vote, and also to make the opportunity that his economic plan is better. And looking specifically on the economics of it all, Senator McCain said that now he wants to extend the Bush tax cuts, which for so many years did a lot to revitalize the economy. But he has to be very careful. If he aligns himself too closely with the Bush administration, with the slowdown in the economy, people are going to suggest that this would be a third term of the Bush administration. So he does need to differentiate himself on what he believes and how he is different than the president and why his vision is a different and a new vision for the country.
Donna, do you think that he has some shackles with the president, not basically having an almost legendary unpopularity rating at this point?
You know, what's interesting is that given the fight inside the Democratic Party, I don't see why John McCain is not winning by a landslide. In the most recent New York Times CBS poll, both Senator Clinton as well as Senator Obama has beaten Senator McCain. I think he has some fundamental structural problems. One is a president whose approval rating is now under 30%. Secondly, the Republican brand itself is in trouble. And while, you know, the media is focused on the Democratic divisions, there are some divisions still in the Republican Party, and he needs to heal them. And on the substance of the matter, in terms of the issues, Iraq, the economy, health care, John McCain needs a makeover. Iraq is a pretty tough issue. Over 70% of the American people would like to see us withdraw to bring our troops home. They believe the mission has been accomplished, and it's time to, you know, bring our troops home and to let the Iraqi government heal their own wounds. On the economy, John McCain is finally trying to find his voice. Took him 3 weeks to come up with a credible answer on the housing crisis. So I don't think Democrats right now focus too much on John McCain because they know that time will come to go after John McCain to appeal to independents and maybe try to pick up some Republicans in the process.
All right, Donna, Ron, I want to turn to some congressional races. First off, two veterans on Capitol Hill could face tough competition. In New York, 13-term incumbent Congressman Adolphus Towns will face author and activist Kevin Powell. Powell was one of the original cast members of MTV's Real World and got into hot water for an expletive-filled fight with one of his white castmates. Now he has moved on and focused on ending sexism among black men. He ran against Towns 2 years ago but dropped out of the race early. Towns only won 47% of the vote during a three-way race in 2006. Now, Ron, could Towns be in trouble?
I think he could be. And as partisan as a Republican as I am, I had the opportunity to work with Congressman Towns and his staff in my nearly decade of service on Capitol Hill. He's a very nice man, a very likable man, very intelligent man. But the voters have the opportunity every 2 years, if they're not happy with their candidates, to cast them aside. Mr. Powell has made an impassioned plea to seek the vote from his constituents-to-be. And while I think that Mr. Towns will ultimately prevail in this contest if everything holds up the way that it is now, you can never rest on your laurels, and that's one thing that got the Democrats in trouble when they lost in 1994, and that's what got us in trouble when we lost a couple of years ago, which is taking the electorate for advantage, and I think it's good to have some of these members who have been there for 20, 30 years or more to be pushed from younger people, individuals who want to have a fresh chance and a fresh opportunity to express their ideas. I think it's great for the process.
Donna, a while back we had NAACP board chair Julian Bond and Kevin Powell debating issues of generational leadership in the black community. And I asked Chairman Bond, you know, are you going to pass the mantle from the civil rights generation, or do people have to come up and take it? And he was like, take it, you know, basically bring it on. Is this a case where someone like Kevin Powell is bringing it?
Look, I think Kevin Powell represents a new voice, perhaps a new style of leadership. And there's no question that over the next couple of months, we're going to see new people emerge. As we end this presidential contest, I'm reminded of the 84 Jackson campaign, where Jesse Jackson fertilized the political landscape. And what came of that was a new generation of black leaders who wanted to have their voice at the table, many of them now serving in Congress. So, yes, the Kevin Powells of the world will begin to find their path to political office. And for Congressman Towns and many others on Capitol Hill, this is a new day. And I think they should recognize that not only is it time for a new generation of leadership, but it's time that we have an agenda. I mean, it's not just about personalities. Ron and I might sit here as Republicans and Democrats and disagree on personalities. But if we sat down and say, we got to fix our schools, it's time that we provide real job education opportunities for our youth. If we could sit here and come up with ideas that would motivate people to back our plan, that's what we need more than we need just new faces. We need a roadmap to help black people in the 21st century be able to cope in a global economy.
Ron, I was looking at a picture that ran in Atlanta magazine during the whole 40th anniversary of Reverend King's assassination, and it showed a woman in this beautiful old knit suit with her hat on, kneeling on a protest sign, carrying another protest sign, just the most dignified woman. Like so many who went out, you know, everyone from teenagers to sharecroppers to, you know, middle class and upper middle class black people joined together around the civil rights movement. What would it take to have some kind of a movement that was bipartisan and that had a focus?
I think, candidly, you look at someone like Dr. Martin Luther King and his wife, Coretta Scott King. They were once-in-a-lifetime inspirational figures who were able to galvanize the support of people, white, black, poor, rich, because they had a message that resonated in it. And it goes to what Donna said a few moments ago. It's not so much the people who were involved, but it's the message that resonates, that captivates the imagination and then sparks the interest. And I think, candidly, you've seen a lot of that in the candidacy of Senator Obama. You're looking at millions of people who've never registered to vote before. You're looking at people across college campuses, people of all different demographics who are intrigued by his candidacy and want to learn more. So I think that we do need important young leaders to come up and to replace some of the folks who have been in positions of responsibility in our government. But it's the message and it's the resonance that this person is speaking for me. And, you know, as a last aside, you know, if Donna wants to sit out and pull out some of that famous gumbo of hers and she and I can sit out and pull some issues together, hey, I'm in.
Well, let me move on to one more race. There's 11-term Congressman John Lewis. He's running for election against two candidates, Georgia State Representative Mabel Thomas and 31-year-old activist Reverend Markel Hutchins. Both candidates have criticized Lewis for initially supporting Hillary Clinton's campaign, and then Lewis later switched his superdelegate support to the Obama campaign. Now, when you think about this race, Donna, first of all, is there any chance Lewis will be unseated? And secondly, did he switch his support to save his House seat?
First of all, I have to tell you that John Lewis is one of my personal heroes. So it's very difficult to talk about what circumstances could unseat someone that I have so much admiration and respect. He is a moral voice of reason on voting rights. He is a symbol of an era that really took us from the dark ages into the light of the 21st century in terms of democracy. So for those who are thinking about going against John Lewis, just understand he is a nationally revered figure. He is someone that brings people together. He's an inspirational leader, and they will have to build a credible case to remove him from public office. I understand that people are making age comparisons. I'm 48, so I know there are people who are willing or ready to take my seat at the DNC, and let me tell you, it's a hot seat. Come and get it, because God knows some days I feel like passing it on. But in terms of John Lewis, back Hillary Clinton like many other black leaders who came out initially because they clearly knew the Clintons. They've worked with the Clintons. They have been involved with the Clintons. But when John Lewis saw his district go for Barack Obama, I believe he did the right thing in terms of his own politics. He said, look, my district went with Obama. I'm going with my people. I'm not going to sit here and say it's about, you know, the candidate that I've known when my people say it's the candidate that they want. And that's leadership. So it's not political opportunism. It's leadership. Because there are many people today who are saying, well, my people went with Obama and I'm going to stick with Clinton. Or my people went with Clinton. I'm going to stick with Obama. So I know Mabel Thomas. She is a personal friend. She is a fierce. Organizer, tenacious leader. Hillary Clinton would have a great running mate in Mabel Thomas, and I'm sure if she takes on John Lewis, that will be a fight that I would like to witness, but I know where I would take my position, and that is in strongly encouraging John Lewis to fight the good fight, because he has always fought for justice and equality for all Americans.
Now, Ron, when it comes to this, considering we were just talking about intergenerational issues, do you think this is another case of those issues rearing their head?
Look, I think it's wrong if you're going to oppose Congressman Lewis. I mean, my objectivity is about as skewered as Donna's. He has been a revered figure, regardless of your politics or your political affiliation, in particular for me, for being a young 20-something on the Hill back in the 90s, that he didn't care I was a Republican. All he cared was there was another young man trying to get involved in the political process, and he's been a mentor to so many of us. If you're going to try to unseat a lion like this from the civil rights movement, someone who provided opportunities for younger folks like myself and Donna to succeed, to go to school, to get an education, and to compete, if you're going to do it over switching your support from Senator Clinton to Senator Obama, I'd suggest that you need to find a real issue to focus on.
Well, on that note, Ron and Donna, thanks so much.
Thank Pleasure. You.
Democratic strategist Donna Brazile is an author and nationally syndicated columnist, and Ron Christie is vice president of the lobbying group DC Navigators. Both joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. A very influential member of Detroit City Council got some schooling from an eighth grader for her bad behavior. We posted the entire episode on our website, and Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes. He's with us now to share the story and your reactions. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, what's up, Farai?
Well, Monica Conyers is a member of the Detroit City Council, and she happens to be the wife of U.S. Congressman John Conyers. She recently launched into a schoolyard rant against the council president. It happened during a hearing about Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick text message scandal. Tell us a little bit more about what went on.
Well, fortunately for us, the entire thing is on video. It started on the Detroit News website and made its way to YouTube. And it started when Detroit Councilwoman Conyers, as you said, had some fighting words for the group's president in the middle of an active council meeting. So here's some of what happened.
Everybody. Be respectful. Me, you may not do that at home, but you're going to do it up in here.
Stop interrupting.
You grow up. Oh, control your house, and you know how to treat other women better.
You're the last one to talk.
I'm the first one to talk.
Council member.
Shrek.
Shrek.
You're out of
Shrek.
Order.
The first one to talk. Don't
you're
disrespect
out of order.
Me.
Order of the you- day.
Well, then. So after that, the Detroit News convened a panel of school kids to talk with Conyers about her behavior. Now, one girl in particular tried to set her straight. So here's part of that conversation between Conyers and eighth grader Kiara Bell.
Now you're telling me what I should have and should not have done.
Well, you're an adult. You have that choice.
I'm what?
You're an adult. You have that choice.
And everybody has choices.
But sometimes people need to think before they act.
Think before they act. So that was Kiara Bell, and we talked about this online. One of our readers named Emma wrote, "Now that was hilarious. Kudos to young Miss Bell for giving the councilwoman some perspective." Another reader named Dan Schmidt wrote, "I would really enjoy having a student like that in my class." And Matthew Scallon wrote simply, "From the mouths of babes."
We've also been talking about the Democratic primaries in Indiana and North Carolina. There was some talk that black voters may stay home instead of voting if Hillary Clinton wins the nomination. So what are folks saying online?
We're saying just that. Mona Rock wrote, "I will not vote if Hillary Clinton is the nominee. I will choose to leave that position blank." Ruby Peters took another vantage point. She goes, "Maybe the question should be women to stay home if Obama is the nominee. This woman will." And John Jay wrote, "I will never stay home during an election. If you stay home, you do a disservice to all those who risk their lives by going to the polls." And we should say that the group The Color of Change, the Netroots group which organized political action around Hurricane Katrina and Gina 6, has released an online letter to superdelegates saying that they should support the will of the voters, which to them means supporting Barack Obama.
Now, you were the man who innovated the whole casting scheme of the Obama movie where you can go on and vote. Time Magazine's now out with its list of the most influential people in the world. I understand we have a list of our own.
Yeah, and we took it a step further. We compiled a list of the most and least influential black people in the entire world. So among the most influential, we have Barack Obama, Oprah Winfrey, who are pretty obvious. And the least influential, with help from our readers, we've come up with Marla Gibbs, comedian Ricky Smiley, Tracy Morgan, and Master P. And our dubious list is growing as the days go on.
I hope we don't get any letters from the least influential people, Jeff.
Right.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me from our studios at NPR West. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. On April 25th, three New York City police officers were acquitted on all counts of shooting Sean Bell. In 2006, the officers fired 50 bullets at Bell and his friends as they were leaving Bell's bachelor party. Bell was unarmed. There were only muted protests following the verdict, but today the Reverend Al Sharpton, members of Bell's family, and other community leaders are taking these protests one step further. They'll march and stage pray-ins throughout New York City. One of the sites is House of the Lord Church in downtown Brooklyn, led by the Reverend Herb Daughtry. We talked to the Reverend yesterday about his plans for the protest.
What we propose to do is assemble at various sites around the city and then march to the action site. That is the place where we will submit ourselves, some of us, to an arrest. Hopefully, in so doing, we will tie up the city so that there would be no movement, no motion. And everybody in the city, and indeed across the nation, will get the message that we will not stand for policemen, the people we pay to protect us, to kill us.
Reverend, when you talk about blocking things off and shutting things down, does that mean that you will literally block the streets?
Obviously, I don't want to be too specific, but we have assembling points, points where we tell people to assemble. Here in Brooklyn, it says our church, the House of the Lord Church. Now, once people have assembled, then we will go to the designated sites of action where the civil disobedience will take place.
Sean Bell was a young man. Have you been able to reach out to people who were in their 20s or even in their teens to try to get them to join on to this protest?
Oh, by all means. I mean, the family in particular has been courageous. I've been at this 50 years now, and sometimes families withdraw, and we understand that. But this family has been a model of participation in all of the rallies, the demonstrations that we've had, and some of the members will be arrested. Therefore, they have sent a message across the city, indeed across the nation, rallying young people, because Sean was about 22, 23, rallying young people to this cause.
Now, you and Reverend Sharpton's National Action Network were involved in protests around the shooting death of Amadou Diallo. Civil disobedience played a big role in those protests. What do you think those protests taught you, or what did you learn from them?
Well, you know, we've been doing this across the years. There's nothing new about a civil disobedience. But having 1,200 people arrested in a daily civil disobedience venture is phenomenal. It made an impact upon the police department itself and upon the politics in New York. Giuliani was the mayor at that time. We hope that we will have a residential law. That is to say that policemen should live where they work. So that would mean you kill where you live. And I suspect that if you're going to kill where you live, you'd be more inclined not to kill. And we hope that there would be an independent civilian complaint review board that would review the behavior of the police.
Reverend, if you are not imprisoned on civil disobedience charges, would you be willing to come on tomorrow and update us about the protest?
I'd be delighted to do so.
Well, Reverend, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
The Reverend Herb Daughtry leads the House of the Lord Church in downtown Brooklyn. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. On April 25th, three New York City police officers were acquitted on all counts of shooting Sean Bell. In 2006, the officers fired 50 bullets at Bell and his friends as they were leaving Bell's bachelor party. Bell was unarmed. There were only muted protests following the verdict, but today the Reverend Al Sharpton, members of Bell's family, and other community leaders are taking these protests one step further. They'll march and stage pray-ins throughout New York City. One of the sites is House of the Lord Church in downtown Brooklyn, led by the Reverend Herb Daughtry. We talked to the Reverend yesterday about his plans for the protest.
What we propose to do is assemble at various sites around the city and then march to the action site. That is the place where we will submit ourselves, some of us, to an arrest. Hopefully, in so doing, we will tie up the city so that there would be no movement, no motion. And everybody in the city, and indeed across the nation, will get the message that we will not stand for policemen, the people we pay to protect us, to kill us.
Reverend, when you talk about blocking things off and shutting things down, does that mean that you will literally block the streets?
Obviously, I don't want to be too specific, but we have assembling points, points where we tell people to assemble. Here in Brooklyn, it says our church, the House of the Lord Church. Now, once people have assembled, then we will go to the designated sites of action where the civil disobedience will take place.
Sean Bell was a young man. Have you been able to reach out to people who were in their 20s or even in their teens to try to get them to join on to this protest?
Oh, by all means. I mean, the family in particular has been courageous. I've been at this 50 years now, and sometimes families withdraw, and we understand that. But this family has been a model of participation in all of the rallies, the demonstrations that we've had, and some of the members will be arrested. Therefore, they have sent a message across the city, indeed across the nation, rallying young people, because Sean was about 22, 23, rallying young people to this cause.
Now, you and Reverend Sharpton's National Action Network were involved in protests around the shooting death of Amadou Diallo. Civil disobedience played a big role in those protests. What do you think those protests taught you, or what did you learn from them?
Well, you know, we've been doing this across the years. There's nothing new about a civil disobedience. But having 1,200 people arrested in a daily civil disobedience venture is phenomenal. It made an impact upon the police department itself and upon the politics in New York. Giuliani was the mayor at that time. We hope that we will have a residential law. That is to say that policemen should live where they work. So that would mean you kill where you live. And I suspect that if you're going to kill where you live, you'd be more inclined not to kill. And we hope that there would be an independent civilian complaint review board that would review the behavior of the police.
Reverend, if you are not imprisoned on civil disobedience charges, would you be willing to come on tomorrow and update us about the protest?
I'd be delighted to do so.
Well, Reverend, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
The Reverend Herb Daughtry leads the House of the Lord Church in downtown Brooklyn. We're going to debate the possible impact of Reverend Al Sharpton's New York pray-in, weigh in on the Indiana and North Carolina primary results, and remember the pioneer of interracial marriage laws, Mildred Loving. That's all on today's Bloggers Roundtable. With us, Carmen Van Kerkhove. She blogs at Racialicious. She's also the co-founder and president of New Demographic, an anti-racism training company. And Baratunde Thurston, he's a blogger for sites including the Huffington Post. He also writes for Jack and Jill Politics under the pseudonym Jack Turner. Plus, education analyst Casey Lartig. His blog is The Casey Lartig Show. Welcome, folks.
Thank you for inviting us.
Hey, thanks for having us.
So we just heard from Reverend Herb Daughtry of the House of the Lord Church in Brooklyn. His storefront church is one of the places people are meeting today on their way to pray-ins. They're protesting the verdict in the trial of three NYPD detectives who shot and killed Sean Bell. Two of the officers who fired at Bell were black themselves. Now, Al Sharpton is spearheading the protest. He says the goal of the pray-ins is to actually shut down New York City. Baratunde and Carmen, you are in New York. Baratunde first, what are people saying about the protest?
Well, I'm getting some excitement from some people that something's actually happening. You know, Black Agenda Report had a great phrase to describe the decision. They said that the decision may have been legal, but it wasn't just. And there's a strong sense in the community that this was an act of injustice, that justice was not served. So on the one hand, you have people who are glad that something's going down. There's always conflicted feelings raised when it's Al Sharpton who is sort of leading something, and he's a double-edged sword. He can bring a spotlight like no other, but he also brings a spotlight like no other.
Carmen, what about that double-edged sword of Al Sharpton's involvement?
Yeah, I think Sharpton is definitely a controversial figure. I think it's great on the one hand that, you know, African Americans have someone like him to really, you know, draw attention to issues. But on the other hand, there are a lot of white folks who really regard him as some kind of a huckster and a race baiter. And so it definitely is a double-edged sword, just as Baratunde said.
Now, after the verdict, many people expected large and immediate protests, but the city was relatively quiet. Now, when you think about this, Casey, why do you think there was a delayed reaction? And also, let me ask you, are black folks in D.C. even paying attention to this case?
First of all, I haven't heard about people boarding buses to get to New York to protest this. And there's been very little talk, as far as I've heard, on black talk radio locally. I mean, obviously some, but not within the last couple of days. But I think the problem that the reason there hasn't been a lot of action is what the two other guests have mentioned, and that is Al Sharpton. I mean, with so much nonsense mixed in, it's hard to tell what is injustice and what is street theater with them. Because, you know, he'll take delusional women and criminals at their word. So it's hard for us to take him at his word when he says, here's something that you need to get involved in. So, and you know, it's not just about Sharpton, because I've got my suspicions about people like Alan Dershowitz, because, you know, if you're his client, I'm suspicious. And I think that's the kind of thing that's happened with Sharpton. People are just always suspicious.
I also think, if I might jump in really quickly, that there's some set of fatigue. We've had so many cases like this. It's obvious that we have a dual
justice system. Think about it. Tawana Brawley, Duke rape case, Crown Heights, Bensonhurst. I mean, Freddie's Fashion Mart, Diallo, Jenna 6, some good, some bad. But he's always there. He has all the credibility of a public defender. You just had your little promo earlier about public defenders.
Now, we've got some bloggers that we've been checking out, and one of them wrote, there's a lot less anger over this verdict than Al Sharpton thinks. Most black folks realize that Bell was shot by black people. Relax, Al. Nobody is getting too upset over your silly protest. Impacting the commerce in New York only hurts your community. Carmen, do you think, I mean, this is something that has come up again and again, especially with the Jenna 6 case, which did rally huge amounts of people to one fixed location. Do you think protests are, I mean, how important are they to modern civil rights and legal rights?
I think protests are still a very effective tool, because anytime you can get a large number of people together in one place, that creates a good visual spectacle for a very image-driven media. However, I do want to address the point about the fact that, you know, some of the cops involved were people of color themselves. And I think a lot of people, you know, really harp on this fact. But here's the thing. I mean, the media is constantly bombarding us with images that really criminalize young black men. And so it's not as if you are a person of color yourself, you're automatically shielded from internalizing some of this stuff. So it's absolutely possible for black cops, Latino cops, to have the same sort of, you know, gut reactions about criminalizing young black men in their minds and thus reacting violently. And so I really think that that's an important point that we should really discuss.
And I'd say more important than their race, you know, whether they're black or white, is they're blue. And they hide behind the shield of the power of the state. And it's the state here, not the color of the officers, that has this pattern of criminalizing and killing black people way beyond the numbers that would be just.
Yeah, but, you know, this is the old problem that very often there are incidents that if the Ku Klux Klan or some white people were involved, that black people would be out rallying, ready to just burn stuff down. But they're a little more confused when it is a case like this, that there are black people involved. And then this becomes a question of, okay, so you got a guy who's, you know, a former drug dealer who allegedly was trying to run over the cops. So then it's like, it's not such an easy case as it would be like, what, they're white cops. They
All
obviously
right.
must have been after him because he's black.
I want to go into a speed round here on this one topic because we've talked quite a bit about it, and that is the elections. You know, Senator Obama completely sweeping North Carolina and Senator Clinton getting 3% victory over in Indiana. So speed round, what do you think's going to happen, you know, over the course of the next few weeks? Baratunde.
I am just happy to welcome the mainstream media to the Democratic primary. They finally caught on to the wrath of the math, which hasn't changed much since Obama's 12-state sweep post-Super Tuesday. And that, I think, is the biggest change. The facts on the ground haven't changed. The media narrative and perception is very important, and it has, and I'm glad to see that it's happening.
Carmen?
Yeah, I mean, I think Baratunde and a lot of other bloggers have really brought up this angle in the media, which has been very much harping on whether Obama can win the white vote and not really asking whether Hillary Clinton can win the black vote. And so I'm glad to finally see that question being raised more and more. And, you know, hopefully let's wrap this thing up.
Casey?
Yeah, ultimately, I mean, there's going to be a big fight. But in the end, 85 to 90% of black people are going to vote for Democrats and, again, have their votes taken for granted.
I want to move on finally to the passing of a woman named Mildred Loving. She passed away on Friday. Her last name always reminded people of her place in history. She and her husband, who was white, changed history in 1967 when the U.S. Supreme Court upheld their right to marry. The state of Virginia, even at that late date, forbade interracial marriage, and their case changed laws across the country. So Mildred Loving rarely gave interviews, but last year on the 40th anniversary of the case, she said, "I am proud that Richards and my name is on a court case that can help reinforce the love, the commitment, the fairness, and the family that so many people, black or white, young or old, gay or straight, seek in life. I support the freedom to marry for all." That's what Loving and Loving are all about. Carmen, how significant was this case and Mildred Loving?
It was very significant. I mean, it was definitely groundbreaking. One thing that a lot of people don't realize is after the Loving versus Virginia Act was passed, a lot of states continued to keep the anti-miscegenation laws on their books, even though they weren't allowed to really enforce them. And what's interesting is that in 2000, the state of Alabama held a special election to decide whether or not to take those laws off the books. And over 40% of the residents voted to keep the laws. And so I think that really is an eye-opening fact in showing that there is still a lot of opposition to interracial relationships in this day and age.
Baratunde, Virginia used to be the heart of the Confederacy. And when you think about outlawing interracial marriage, there have been interracial relationships, some of them coerced, including rape during the days of slavery, some of them consensual. Is it ironic that there's so much mixed blood in virtually all African Americans, but that the law said people could not marry?
I don't quite consider it ironic. I think it's a vestige of the fears and the commitment to white supremacy that our laws have so often reflected. And it still shocks me that this was only 40 years ago. We have a very strong image of our country as super progressive and enlightened, but 40 years is not that long ago. And 2000, as Karma just pointed out, is even closer. I also love that Loving said equal rights for all marriages, that in a day and age when same-sex couples are denied their rights, we have the same conversation going on. And I think it's actually time to keep extending equal marriage rights under the law to all of our citizens.
Casey, some countries, including South Africa, have laws on the books, you know, national laws saying that gays and lesbians can marry. Do you think that when Mildred Loving says something like what she says, do you think that there's room for a groundswell of support among African Americans, among Americans as a whole, to really reconsider the issue of gay marriage, which has been so far very controversial, very much a wedge issue?
Yeah, it probably won't happen because I think, unfortunately, a lot of people still look at it as, you know, it was because of race that we were denied. But now it's because, you know, I mean, if you're gay, you can kind of hide it. You can still have your life. But I think we need to focus on that this is about the relationship of consenting adults with their government. And that is that you're able, when you come up with your marital plans, that you don't have to tell the government. I mean, you have to give the government notification, but you don't have to seek permission. We need to focus more on the fact that as an individual, I can choose the person that I want to marry, again, as an adult.
Finally, it's all about attitude at this point. And there are a lot of people who still don't like interracial relationships. There's an upswing in black women marrying outside the race. The black men still have the lead. Baratunde, among your extended cohort, do you get the sense that people are accepting or suspicious of interracial relationships?
Yes, and both. I think you always find throughout history probably that younger people are much more open to things that buck some of the rules of older society. So among my peers, there's a pretty open attitude, although there are still tensions, obviously, due to the historical context that we can't ever fully escape.
Carmen?
Yeah, I mean, I think that race gets very sexualized, and so there are always a lot of underlying suspicions about people's motivations for getting into interracial relationships. You know, is it just some kind of fetish, some kind of fascination? And so I think, you know, that overall there's more acceptance, but that acceptance isn't really complete, and I think it comes with a lot of underlying assumptions and question marks.
All right, we're going to have to wrap it up. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Baratunde Thurston. He blogs at the Huffington Post and Jack and Jill Politics, plus Carmen Van Kerkhove, who blogs at Racialicious. Both were at our New York studios. And Casey Lartigue's blog is called The Casey Lartigue Show. He was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation doesn't stop here. Our online series, Speak Your Mind, gives you a chance to sound off on the issues you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org. And click on Speak Your Mind. That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, how the Stop Snitching movement is making vendetta justice the only justice in some urban communities.